Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch on this lovely, lovely, beautiful Thursday. It is the day before the month ends and it is wild. It's raining in Windhoek City and it is a nice weather. You know, small, small rain like these, we're all getting pregnant. It is what it is. All right, ladies and gentlemen. So today we're talking about thinking skills. Né? We're talking about thinking skills, the ability to learn them. What are they? And how to acquire this. Now, has somebody ever told you that you win? You don't know how to think for yourself. And usually the person that's telling you this is a person that lacks common sense, but you are like, okay, so they're my elder. Let me just listen and don't judge. Listen and don't judge, because you can't just go around bashing elders. You know, elders, what? And you know, it's rough out there. It's rough. It's not an easy task, but it does happen. Or sometimes you just really lack critical thinking. Now, how do we develop it? I don't know. What is it? Critical thinking is the process of objectively analyzing information, questioning assumptions, and evaluating evidence to form a reasonable judgment or make a well-informed decision. So this is not you, the impulsive sister. This is not you, the impulsive brother. This is not you that is just deciding, oh my goodness, she's not answering my phone, I'm gonna rock up at her mother's house. What is wrong with you? Hey, like, no, not like that. How? It's not like that. We are talking about applying reason, evaluating evidence, questioning, objectively analyzing, not just analyzing, but objectively analyzing the information presented to you. When your friends are coming forth with information and then you are just eating it up, ain't you? You're eating it up. And you are not even doing, you know what? Let me evaluate this nicely. Let me apply my mind to it. Let me apply understanding to it. Let me try remembering. Let me try evaluating the circumstances that were said to be beyond somebody's control. Were they truly and honestly beyond somebody's control? Now, there's a difference between overthinking, because overthinking always goes negative, right? You always just, oh my goodness, okay, so this person is not answering. This person is probably outside there and they're just probably chilling and living their best lives. They're cheating on me. They hate me. They don't love me anymore. Oh my goodness, I'm not no longer worthy. And woo, overthinker. That's an overthinker. Now, if we are doing critical thinking, right, we are thinking about, okay, so the last time I spoke to this person was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And she had mentioned that she was walking from school. So the likelihood of her not having her phone, it's 6 o'clock now, it's 2 hours, right? And her house is, it's only an hour's walk, right? So the likelihood of her not having her phone on loud is very high, because we don't want to get robbed. We just most probably poked it somewhere. So the most logical thing for me to do is to wait and see if she's going to call me at least at 8 o'clock, because she gets home at 6 o'clock and then she has to get busy with the pots, and then she has to also get calm down, take a shower, get into the home clothes, you know, relax, unwind, do your thing. So she needs also like that little breathing space before she starts getting interactive with me. So let me give her that breathing space until 8 o'clock, and then I'll see from there. If she hasn't called me yet, then I would know something is up. Critical thinking. Not just jumping to conclusions like, hey, she's cheating on me. Where she was walking with, who was she walking? Oh my goodness. No, it's not like that. It's not supposed to be like that, lovey. It's supposed to be a little bit different than that, ne? It's supposed to be something wonderful. Something that you really apply reason to. Something that you apply reason to. Something that you are enjoying. something that we can say, which, okay, not really enjoying, but you know, it's not something that's dreading you and giving you more anxiety than you should have. You know, that's overthinking. So critical thinking is the process of objectively analyzing information. You know, when the information is presented to you, you don't just eat it up. You don't just run with it. You don't just say, yes, this is absolutely correct, without analyzing it, without breaking it down, without understanding or comprehending the information that you are being fed. And then there is also questioning assumptions. Now, questioning assumptions is when somebody, when you assume something, right? Question it. Like, no, I just assumed. I just assumed that you were going to call me. I just assumed that you were going to call me. But assume, nah, it has its own definition in my heart. But you can't just assume. You must question your assumptions, right? Okay, so this person left school at 4 o'clock. And she gets home and now it's 8 o'clock after you have given the time. And then after that, you decide to get into panic mode. You decide, like, you know what? I'm not going to call her because she should have called me first, because, you know, like, she's supposed to call me because I've given her enough time. So if she doesn't want to call me, we're most probably breaking up. You guys jump to conclusions all the time. Yeah? Just jump straight into it. Nobody gave you a reason to, you just jumping straight into it. We were in love the whole time. And then I just go mute for 2 hours. We are giving up on the relationship. It's a wrap. Done. You have to question, okay, so she's supposed to. Okay. With what? I assume she must have airtime from where? Eh? And if you have been the one that has been calling the whole entire day because she's been sending you call me requests and she has already sent you 5, why are you assuming that she must call you? Call you from where? Eh? You see, question your assumptions, because your assumptions are usually the things that are going to make you just plummage into a world of unknown, a world of no. Don't do that. So, no, darling, let's not do that. Let's not do that one. And then evaluating evidence. When evidence is presented in front of you, evaluate it. Because sometimes this evidence that is, the law of evidence is a very strong law. Because as long as it's there and we can see it, we can smell it, we can touch it, we can feel it, then it must be real. And most probably some of the cases of evidence is also, okay, let's not go into the law of evidence, because I was going to go on about something that is not, it's not part of our conversation. So it is also evaluating the evidence that is put in front of you to form a reasonable and sensible judgment. Okay, so this person was really here and this person was really there because of this video footage that is put somewhere, and because of what that is done where, I would like for us to say that, okay, so this person really did do it because the evidence says that this person has done it. Or make a well-informed decision. You must think about your decisions before you make them. You must not just run and go and do whatever you are feeling like you should do, especially when it's a wrong move, right? Then you must always evaluate the way you are going to do things. You must make good decisions. Make good decisions. Now, core components of critical thinking. Like, what are the core components of critical thinking? First of all, you have to analyze. Break down information to understand its components and relationships. Break down the information so that you understand the relationship between this one and this one and how they piece things together. So it is a matter of putting, they say, two and two together, putting two and two together and making that four, but you have to put them together yourself. So you have to say that, okay, so Eliphaz was coming out of my girlfriend's house at 4 a.m. in the morning after my girlfriend had not been answering. So it is most likely to say that the likelihood of them having been together in the hut at 4 a.m. is high. But also you have to analyze, where did your girlfriend say that she's going? And is your girlfriend really in the premises, right? In order for you to say that she's now having a romantic relationship with Elias, or Eliphaz, or whoever, Elia. And we have to put these two and two together. And when we put these two and two together, we can see the relationship between the two assumptions that we are making, and we can evaluate it, okay?
Great news! Impact just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Alrighty, good evening to you. If you have just joined us, this is Pulling Heartstrings, and I was trying to reach out to our beloved baby Aina. It is her birthday today, but I think she is mumwalaring and she's enjoying this birthday things. So I guess we'll speak to her a little bit later. But tonight we're talking about critical thinking, and we're talking about how to develop those kinds of skills, you know? So the second one that we have on the agenda today is evaluation. Assessing the credibility and relevance of the information and argument. Evaluating the credibility. So you, when I, you're just hearing from the grapevines that FNB, for example, FNB is giving away money. Tomorrow we must all be at town square, what, at the meteorites, what, because FNB is going to be giving out money. Now, the question is, how do you assess the credibility of the person that is telling you? One, they must give you evidence of this information. And two, like, you must look at this person that's giving you this information, and then also look at the likelihood of FNB just standing outside saying, okay guys, I'm giving away money. Because at the end of the day, who is FNB if it's not an entity? So FNB is not a person, like, saying that, oh no, Tate Cool Drink is going to be standing outside dishing out money. FNB is an entity, and also if you are an FNB client, they would most probably, you know, send you a text to say that, oh guys, we're giving away money. Or they would have made it easier and just send the money onto your account and say, yeah, this was a bonus. The same way they do with the savings pocket, you know, this was a bonus. This was a what? Mara. Apparently you're believing this guy, and you're waking up early in the morning to go and stand at the meteorite, and it's only you and that person that's there. And even the person that apparently gave the person the information is not there. But you have to go down into the chain of command. You have to go down and see, okay, so who told you this? Yeah, I received an SMS. Let me see that SMS. Now, if you go and see the SMS and the SMS looks from a dodgy number, then the question would be how. But we can always just call. Yeah, we can call and confirm that this is real. But you guys don't do that. You guys don't do that because, well, you guys are hot girls and beautiful guys, and you guys are just following whatever information is given out there to you. Which I know, guys. We're going to have free education. We're going to have free tertiary. Like, really? Is that in your job description, ma'am? I'm just asking, is it in your job description? And what happens, you know, if it's going to be free, who's going to be paying the institution, you know? Like, so is it going to be taxpayers' money that is now going to be pushed towards the universities that are government? Or what now? So how are we going to do this? Yeah, we all eat up information, but is it credible? It's the same way as this guy is going to come and advocate or going to come and rally and say, like, yes, I'm going to bring this, I'm going to bring that. But the question is credibility. Is this part of your job description? Is this part of your job description? Do you give out these bazaaries at your office? If you are elected for office, do you give out these bazaaries? Or are you going to apparently go and tell the people to give out bazaaries, but it's not in your job description to tell people what to do with money? Are you at finance? Eh? I'm asking. It's an ask. Are you at the place where they make mandates and they make laws and they do this? Are you at that place? Or are you just an ordinary citizen that's now a counselor? Or who's it? Vathanan. Because I think we saw flames when some of our politicians took office. in various sectors of the government or the system, right? Where we saw people that were saying, yes, we want land, we want land, we want land. They were all dressed up. We want land and we want what and we want if you make me. And then they got to office and then they got hit by the harsh reality of it doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that, and you are not supposed to be doing that, and here are the rules and regulations, and here is your contract, and here is your memorandum of understanding, and here is your non-disclosure. So whatever is done here, you can never go and speak about it ever. So the world is just going to call you a liar, right? But you are not allowed to come and tell us that, yeah, my job says that I can't, it's like I'm not supposed to do this. No, you can't blame us for the promises that you're going to make out there, because nobody asked you to make those promises. You just went to make those promises without being fully informed of your role that you're going to play. And also, one of the things that we can put out there is that there were cones, and now there are no cones anymore. Hey, the number in studio is 083-288-401. That's the number in studio. So it is assessing the credibility, and the relevance of the information. Is this information that I am being given relevant? Is this information that is going to be vital for me? Is it going to be good for me? Is it going to build me? Or is it just unnecessary information that fills my head? So I have this thing at home, because at home I get asked a lot of like nonsense, you know, nonsense. I get asked a lot of nonsense, and there's a lot of chit chat that happens in my home, right? And at some point, I just told my family members, my relatives, ne? Mainly my children and Habibi, I just told them that, guys, I can't fill my mind with all the things that you guys ask me on a daily basis. Mommy, is my stomach like this? Mommy, what do you think of? Mommy, I'm like, ah, guys, cut me some slack. Cut me some slack. Give me a moment so that I can just be in my head and be in myself and be in my skin without you coming to load me with unnecessary information. And this unnecessary information could also be, it's not that it's unnecessary. It's just not something, it's not relevant for me right now. Because right now I'm thinking about something else. You can't come and bomb me with, you know, did you know, that I was like smiling, and then when I was not smiling anymore, then I decided that, ah, no, guys, no, not now. Eh? You can tell me later, not now. My daughter gets into the car today, and she's coming from school, and she's my bestie. So she gets into the car and she's like, mommy, I'm like, yes, my girl. What's up, sis? And you know, I'm like, hey, what's up, sis? Oh, today was so dramatic. I'm like, talk to me, sis. And it was so nice. It was so nice. I loved it so much. I loved the experience. Hey, it was like, we're talking it's like I'm part of her life, bruh. I was like, wow, I'm honored. She's like, I'm like, she didn't even greet anybody else. She's like, just straight to mommy, you know. It's like, mommy, oh my goodness, there was so much drama today. Today was such a nice day. It was such an epic day. It was a little bit dramatic. I'm like, what happened, sis? And she's like, mom, you know what? I'm like, sis, tell me about it. And she's like, well, today teacher was saying, I'm like, yeah, you know, and it was so anticlimactic, I promise. I promise, with all this hype that I was giving, it was so anticlimactic. But I really honestly genuinely thought, because of the oomph and the vuma she came with, she was going to give me a climatic story about, oh my goodness, and then. So she's telling me about, yeah, and then this other guy pushed Bashir, and then I found Bashir, and then Bashir was crying, and I was thinking that, oh my goodness, she pull up, you know, she pull up on the person that beat Bashir, you know, because my daughter doesn't take nonsense like that. And I was like, oh, she pull up. And then she's like, and then that's all, teacher just came. Ha. But I think that at that moment, she learned to filter. In that moment, on this particular day, she learned to filter, because I think she realized that the direction in which the story was going to go, critical thinking, because she was just going to blab, ne? And that's why I was thinking about critical thinking. I was like, okay, that's smart, because the way the story was going to go was that she most probably got aggressive with somebody. But then I'm also her mother. And her mother is not about you guys pulling up and taking Osaka Shideni and starting fights at school. Not unless the fight is yours, then you go for it. But if the fight is not yours, who are you? Who are you to be pulling up some detention papers, some red, blue papers? Ah. And then I think that in that moment, she applied critical thinking. And she's like, well, how is this story going to influence the future? And then she's like, and then teacher came. I was like, bruh. I was like, yo, sis, what's up, sis? I was like, sis. Oh, he didn't. I was doing all of the theatrics. I was doing everything that a hype man should do. And then she just ends it with, yeah. And then teacher came. I'm like, is that true? We all turned around and looked at her. I was like, Natasha, Sister Natasha, is that the truth? You know, she's like, mm-hmm. I was like, hey. She learned critical thinking and lying in the same breath. Huzzah. I was like, wow, I don't know how I feel about this, but okay, cool. But at least she knows I can hype her up. All right. And then number three is, inference, drawing logical conclusions from evidence. Logical conclusions from evidence. You don't just jump to conclusion. You draw logical conclusions that are supported by evidence. And this evidence must not be biased. It must be holistic. It must be truthful. It must be factual. Okay? And then we have the next one is interpretation. Explaining the meaning of information and identifying its significance. Explaining the meaning of the information that you are getting. The meaning. What does this information that I am being given mean? Oh, so it means Cynthia is creeping around with Jones. Oh, okay. Is it significant? Yes, it is significant because Cynthia is my other half. So, if I'm interpreting this correctly, it would be that Cynthia is unfaithful. You see? Ah, finding meaning. All right. Reasoning. Using logic and evidence to justify conclusions. Logic and evidence is when it is logical. It is logical to assume that when you are going to bed, you switch off the lights. It's not logical to assume that a grown-up sleeps with the lights on because it is just not grown-up. Like, not unless there's some form of trauma or fear that comes with lights being off that needs to be dealt with. But on a day-to-day basis, we do not assume that adults sleep with lights on. Okay? That's just logical. All right? This is use logical evidence to justify and your conclusion. So through this evidence that we have, we would just justify ourselves by asking our friends, you know, like maybe you ask your friend, like, are you afraid of the dark? And your friend is like, yeah, defensive. They want to fight you. They want to what? Leave me alone. You're not really my brethren and what, right? And then what would be, yeah, is using logic, you know, to apply to the situation. Logic dictates that adults don't sleep with the lights on. Not unless the evidence would be, or justifying would be, not unless they had suffered something so traumatic that switching the lights on would be a hindrance to their mental health or a hindrance to their sleep. So that is how we apply reason. Okay. And then also for their outbursts, we can justify it with it being something that they are uncomfortable with or embarrassed by. Then we go to problem solving, applying critical thinking skills to find solutions to complex problems. You think critically to find solutions to complex problems, okay? And self-regulation, being aware of your own biases and assumptions and correcting them when necessary, by saying that I might be biased, right? Because it's like you talking about how amazing women are and understanding and being aware of the fact that you might be biased because you are a woman yourself. So you check that, okay?
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHB on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Save and win at WB in the Pick a Box birthday promo. Enter today with your Smart Buy card. Get 4kg Cadilla Mixed Chicken for $189.99. 1kg Pasta Grande Spaghetti for $19.99. 750 gram Nola Mayo for just $37.99. And 2kg Sunlight Hand Wash Powder for only $52.99. Learn more about Pick a Box at www.vurmanbrock.com. T's and C's apply. We care.
Alrighty, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Today we are diving into the world of critical thinking, and we have started now with components of critical thinking, like what makes a critical thinker. A critical thinker has analysis, has evaluation, has interference, has interpretation, has reasoning, has problem-solving skills, and has self-regulation. Those are the components that you need to have as an individual to acquire the skill of critical thinking. Or if you think that you are a critical thinker, you must have at least some of these elements in order for you to qualify as a critical thinker. So, ladies and gentlemen, we should maybe get tips, right, on how to develop critical thinking. Now, we can say that there are four ways. There are four ways to develop critical thinking skills, right? And we can say that number one is questioning. Asking questions to understand what you know and how you know it. Number two, examining evidence, looking closely at the information and sources, including online information, to determine trustworthiness, you know, journalism. Because we are all journalists. All of us are journalists. All of us are FBI. All of us are detective out here. Because anything that we want to know, we always go and find it. All right. And number two, analyzing assumptions, identifying and questioning underlying beliefs and biases in a situation. And number four is considering alternatives, thinking about different interpretations and perspectives before making a conclusion. So that is how to create the skill. That is how to work on it, to enhance it, and to allow it to be better. But ladies and gentlemen, we are going to hear from one of our scholars, and one of our scholars, right? Scholars. One of our scholars, and he's going to be talking about ways to developing critical thinking skills. So, as always, ladies and gentlemen, we as Eagle FM do not take credit for anybody's work. We are strictly just using it for illustration purposes, for learning purposes, for sharing of information purposes. We don't claim ownership of it. We don't say it is ours. We don't even go around saying that, oh, that other TED talk that we had. No. We would rather share this information, especially when the world has become such a beautiful place and information is so available. Enjoy.
I ask you to think about the fact. Is there anything more important than how well we can think? If you don't think so, then I'd ask you to think about the fact that you just had to think that. Right? As we look around the world today at the many serious problems that we're facing, serious problems of war and climate change and untold political strife, I don't think I'm the only one who's noticed, as well as the very real problems we face in our personal lives and the problems that our children will face, is there anyone who thinks that this is a problem of too much critical thinking? Anyone? Anyone? Bueller? Bueller? I don't think so either. And that's why in 2011, I founded the country's first academic office specifically devoted to the teaching of critical thinking, and why I eventually founded the Critical Thinking Institute. I set myself what was a rather humble challenge, a simple ambition, if you will. All I wanted to do was figure out how to teach everybody in the world how to think critically. Yeah, I know. That's it. I also have other humble ambitions. I like tilting at windmills and someday think the New York Giants might win another Super Bowl. But that was my goal. I wanted to teach everybody how to think critically, from kids through teens to adults, through kindergartens and college classrooms and corporate boardrooms. So what is this thing that we call critical thinking? Well, this is just a short list of all the things that critical thinking is. Or in fact, this is just half a short list of all the things that critical thinking is. And I'm sure that all of you could make meaningful additions to this list because it goes on and on and on. With that being the case, how in the world can we teach a human being to do all of these different things well? Well, before we get to that, let's see. How well are we doing with critical thinking? Well, the Stanford History Education Group did a study of how well teens could think critically while they were online. Their conclusion, and I quote, "Young people's ability to reason about information they see on the internet can be summed up in one word, bleak." Don't kill the messenger. And the Wall Street Journal, upon surveying critical thinking outcomes of college students, came to the following rather stark conclusion. Even at some of the most prestigious flagship universities, test results indicate the average graduate shows little or no improvement in critical thinking over 4 years. I know. And if you want to see just how bad it gets, when researchers had college students wear portable brain monitoring devices for a week, they found, as you would expect, varying degrees of brain activity depending upon what the students were doing, whether they were studying or eating a meal or socializing. But the place they consistently found some of the least brain activity was when students were in class. I'm sure that's a wonderful statistic for any of you who are currently putting someone through college. So I wanted to find out why. Why are our critical thinking outcomes so low? And I cannot begin to enumerate for you all of the problems we found with our critical thinking instruction. It would take far too long. I need a lot of TED Talks to accomplish that. But I can share with you our number one reason. Something that no one had solved for and something that challenged us in what turned out to be a decade-long project. We referred to it as the sandbox problem. See, even in the simplest of sandboxes where we have children playing, there are an array of complex critical thinking tasks at work. Well, who's going to get the shovel? How are we going to get this sand out of our shoes? How do we get this other kid to stop throwing sand in everybody's face? What game should we invent? What should the rules be? And why, again, is it that we're not allowed to play in the yellow sand? And that's just the simplest of sandboxes in which we begin, not the metaphoric sandboxes of our lives, sandboxes that obviously become infinitely more complex as we enter adulthood and grapple with the challenges of the real world. In fact, as we take a look at our list of critical thinking skills and we overlay our sandbox on top of it, we find so many of these already present in the simplest of sandboxes. Well, they're problem solving, perhaps about how to move the sand. They're innovating games and ideas. They're arguing, perhaps, over who gets the shovel. In this case, they're inquiring about what other kids think they should do and why. And the list could go on and on. So the sandbox problem for us became as this. Given the complexity of even the simplest sandbox, of all of the critical thinking acts that are taking place in even the simplest sandbox among kids, how do we simplify the teaching of critical thinking enough so that everyone in the world can learn it easily without undermining the complexity of critical thinking itself, the complexity that we see in even the simplest of sandboxes? Whew. Well, that challenged us for years. And whatever research we did, we couldn't find anyone that, to our satisfaction, had solved for this sandbox problem, simplifying the teaching of critical thinking without undermining the complexity of critical thinking. Well, then I had an idea. It occurred to me that if we were ever going to solve the sandbox problem, we would only be able to do so if we relied on how the human brain evolved to think in the first place. Instead of contriving some conception of critical thinking and then trying to get brains to do it, what if instead we figured out how the brain was designed to function? We looked at its most basic operating system, and we built a critical thinking system on that. To figure out how the brain was designed to function, to understand its most basic operating system, the system that's operating no matter where we are and what we're doing, the system that is operating as you're listening to me right now, we had to trace back the origin of how the human brain evolved to think critically. And when I say we traced it back, I mean we traced it back pretty far to primordial ooze. It's an actual picture of primordial ooze from billions of years ago, by the way. So we traced it back to primordial ooze. Because what evolutionary biologists tell us is that from the moment single-celled organisms came to life in that ooze, they were already capable of four thinking acts. Four thinking acts that are the foundation for all of the more advanced critical thinking that we're able to do today. Quoting neuropsychologist Stephen Hughes, those four acts are as follows. They could perceive their environment, sense danger and reward, decide between danger and reward, and act on the decision. In essence, simply put, what's going on around me? What's out there that I might want to eat? What's out there that might want to eat me? How do I weigh some of those pros and cons, and how do I ultimately act upon the decision? You've already been through this same process thousands of times already today. You did it when you decide what to have for breakfast. There are an array of choices available to you in your environment that you surveyed. You weighed some pros and cons about different things in terms of their health benefits, perhaps, or how they tasted and what mood you were in. You made some decisions and put some things on your plate, and then you ate your breakfast. You did it hundreds of times if you drove here today, whether or not to change lanes, how fast to go, where to park. And we do it when we make even the most high-stakes decisions in our lives. Well, decisions around parenting and our children, career choices, and what we do in our careers every single day. So that is the most basic function that's operating in our brains all of the time. And the question became, would it be possible to convert that into a system for critical thinking? Would that solve the sandbox problem? Would it simplify critical thinking enough so that everybody could learn it while maintaining the rich complexity that we need critical thinking to be to contend with the rich problems we're facing in the world? So here are our four steps. Well, it took us a number of years and it took a number of iterations in order to be able to figure out which were the correct overlays that worked for students in learning this to make it easy. We took perceive the environment, where the brain is already in an observational mode, making an assessment of everything that's going on around it. We said, well, what if we harness that power and we augment it? So we taught students techniques for detailed analytic observation. Okay, that's just a fancy way of saying teaching their brains to extract more details from whatever it is they're observing. Now, it doesn't matter if they're observing a Shakespeare play, a nursing simulation,
UCS Combo for just 599 Namibian dollars is so popular that we gladly repeat it. Hurry to get yours. 10 kilogram each of Champion Super Maize Meal, Bokomo Fetgu Flour, Nice Rice, and 10 kilos Marathon White or Brown Sugar. All four products for only 599 Namibian dollars. You save. I save. Yes, we all save at USAVE.
A business proposal? What is being observed is not the point. Conditioning the brain to use that step to extract more details from it is the point. We took the second step and we said, if the brain is already in a mode of asking what's a danger and a reward, what's a threat and what's something to value, then why don't we take that step, harness it, and augment it? So we taught students techniques for complex question clarification. We took the next step to decide between danger and a reward. We said, if the brain is already in a reasoning mode, making determinations between different things, what if we harness that step and augment it and give students techniques for multivariate evaluation? Another fancy way of saying being able to weigh lots of different things against each other at the same time. And we took the final step to act on a decision. We said, well, if the brain is already in a mode of drawing conclusions, let's harness that capacity and augment it and give students the ability to form complex conclusions, the kinds of conclusions that do justice to the complex situations that we face in our lives. So we took all of these things and we distilled critical thinking down to just four acts, four primal acts, four acts that your brain does thousands of times a day. You know, have you ever thought about the fact that we teach students math and we teach them how to write and we teach them how to read, but we do not teach students how to think critically? That seems particularly odd, doesn't it? Well, let me explain to you why that might be. We know the foundation, the core act of teaching people to read. Well, there's sight recognition, there's vocabulary, potentially there's phonics, there's things like that. All the things that you learned when you learned to read. And you use all of those same foundations no matter what you read today as adults. Whether you read things as a doctor, whether you read poetry, whatever it is you read, you do so because you have mastered those core skills of reading. Well, we don't teach people to think critically because perhaps until now, we had not identified the core skills of thinking. But what if those four steps that I described to you are in fact those four core steps of thinking? If we look at our list here, what we discovered was that when we taught students those four steps, all of these other things came along for the ride. Oh, sure, if you're going to engage in innovation, there are certain additional things that we want your brain to do. But the simple fact of the matter is that you cannot engage in problem solving at all without making a detailed observation of the factors that might matter to the problem, formulating a correct and complex, insightful question about that problem, weighing out different pieces of information as they may relate and impact your conclusion to that problem, and ultimately drawing a complex conclusion. Nor can you engage in strategizing. Nor can you engage in innovating, nor can you do any other of the critical thinking acts that we mentioned, nor any of the critical thinking acts that you might be thinking of right now. They all depend first and foremost on that primal skill of critical thinking that we taught students how to do better, something that anyone can learn. Well, how did it work out? We had first and second undergraduates, who after just one course wrote papers that when we presented them to colleagues at other universities were typically rated as graduate level work. Just a 2-week intervention at a high school in Harlem, New York, not only saw wonderful increased gains in critical thinking, but something that we didn't even teach the students. Increased complexity in their sentence structures. Class discussions became richer and more invigorated, with students often being the ones to take the lead. Students who respected one another's ideas more, whether or not they disagreed, sometimes especially if they disagreed. Because regardless of what we thought, we all know that we could respect one another's reasoning process, something that might be important in the world today. And it only worked in every discipline in which we tried it. As noted by faculty in those disciplines and faculty across the discipline, who said they'd never seen such complex critical thinking in their lives. But it also worked outside of class. I can't tell you the number of comments in person and in course evaluations that we received from students who talked about how this affected how they made decisions in their lives. And I got this one note slipped under my door at the end of a semester, which said, it helped me deal with my personal issues and my relationships because it gave me a new way to think through things like never before. This has changed how I think forever. This is one of the few classes I had that isn't just about school. What's better than that? So, we solved the sandbox problem because we built critical thinking on a way that's natural, that leverages our natural, most basic, most instinctive brain function and turned it into an intellectual set of skills. We made it something that everyone in the world can learn, regardless of their age, regardless of what you do, regardless of whether or not you get a fancy education. We found a way to teach critical thinking that was at once easy to learn, yet not only did it undermine the complexity of critical thinking, it augmented it. Listen, researchers tell us this. The single biggest determinant for the decisions our kids make in their lives, high-stakes decisions, with respect to drug use, peer pressure, career choice, is not their raw intellect. It's not how smart they are. It's their critical thinking skills. And a recent survey of 1,000 employers said that the number one skill they are seeking, but do not find enough of, in employees, is critical thinking. Well, we figured out how to teach critical thinking. We figured out how to teach everybody. We can teach it in elementary school classrooms, corporate boardrooms, and everywhere in between. And given the problems facing the world today, I think we could use a little more critical thinking. What do you think? Thank you.
Hi. I have been trying to weasel my way out of being on this stage for weeks. I am terrified. But about a month ago, I was up early panicking about this, and I watched an old TED Talk that Brené Brown did on vulnerability. Dr. Brown is one of my heroes. She is a shame researcher. And I am a recovering bulimic, alcoholic, and drug user. So I'm sort of a shame researcher too. It's just that most of my work is done out in the field. And Dr. Brown defined courage like this. She said, courage is to tell the story of who you are with your whole heart. And that got me thinking about another one of my heroes, Georgia O'Keeffe, and how she said, whether you succeed or not is irrelevant. There is no such thing. Making the unknown known is what is important. So, here I am to tell you the story of who I am with my whole heart and to make some unknowns known. When I was 8 years old, I started to feel exposed and I started to feel very, very awkward. Every day I was pushed out of my house and into school, all oily and pudgy and conspicuous. And to me, the other girls seemed so cool and together and easy. And I started to feel like a loser in a world that preferred superheroes. So I made my own capes and I tied them tight around me. My capes were pretending an addiction. But we all have our own superhero capes, don't we? Perfectionism and overworking, snarkiness and apathy. They're all superhero capes. And our capes are what we put over our real selves so that our real tender selves don't have to be seen and can't be hurt. Our superhero capes are what keep us from having to feel much at all, because every good and bad thing is deflected off of them. And so for 18 years, my capes of addiction and pretending kept me safe and hidden. People think of us addicts as insensitive liars, but we don't start out that way. We start out as extremely sensitive truth tellers. We feel so much pain and so much love, and we sense that the world doesn't want us to feel that much and doesn't want to need as much comfort as we need, so we start pretending. We try to pretend like we're the people that we think we're supposed to be. We numb and we hide and we pretend, and that pretending does eventually turn into a life of lies. But to be fair, we thought we were supposed to be lying. They tell us since we're little that when someone asks us how we're doing, the only appropriate answer is fine, and you? But the thing is that people are truth tellers. We are born to make our unknown known. We will find somewhere to do it. So in private, with the booze or the overshopping or the alcohol or the food, we tell the truth. We say, actually, I'm not fine. Because we don't feel safe telling that truth in the real world, we make our own little world, and that's addiction. That's whatever cape you put on. And so what happens is all of us end up living in these little, teeny, controllable, predictable, dark worlds instead of all together in the big, bright, messy one. I binged and purged for the first time when I was 8, and I continued every single day for the next 18 years. Seems normal to me, but you're surprised. Every single time that I got anxious or worried or angry, I thought something was wrong with me. And so I took that nervous energy to the kitchen and I stuffed it all down with food. And then I panicked and I purged. And after all of that, I was laid out on the bathroom floor and I was so exhausted and so numb that I never had to go back and deal with whatever it was that had made me uncomfortable in the first place. And that's what I wanted. I did not want to deal with the discomfort and messiness of being a human being. So when I was a senior in high school, I finally decided to tell the truth in the real world. I walked into my guidance counselor's office and I said, actually, I'm not fine. Someone help me. And I was sent to a mental hospital. And in the mental hospital, for the first time in my life, I found myself in a world that made sense to me. In high school, we had to care about geometry when our hearts were breaking because we were just bullied in the hallway or no one would sit with us at lunch. And we had to care about ancient Rome when all we really wanted to do was learn how to make and keep a real friend. We had to act tough when we felt scared, and we had to act confident when we felt really confused. Acting, pretending, was a matter of survival. High school is kind of like the real world sometimes. But in the mental hospital, there was no pretending. The jig was up. We had classes about how to express how we really felt through music and art and writing. We had classes about how to be a good listener and how to be brave enough to tell our own story while being kind enough not to tell anybody else's. We held each other's hands sometimes just because we felt like we needed to. Nobody was ever allowed to be left out. Everybody was worthy. That was the rule, just because she existed. And so in there, we were brave enough to take off our capes. All I ever needed to know.
Ritabazende kize imba izwezipiri. Lwekerze mikwaye nguyencha kukona kunolofaza kwankufisa hamo cholo ni mata amska vona kare. Kana mitukserize kuvona msevelezo wa imba ye, mufumane lisevelezo wa zezwezipiri ze kakuli fafela mashilling alika na 36 Namibian dollars kakweli. Kapa kami kwaye kutesfa fasi ye tatama, 5% machipisa hamungo tisari kwerize talu, 10% machipisa hamungo tisari kwerize sirela, 25% machipisa hamungo tisari kwerize Shimiteri. Muketeri kwerizo muvata, kulimukone kukala kuikola zendezeo imba imiswalezi fama chipisa. Imba, toku vukandiri fasi kaufela. Muipe kwa lisevelezo za imba kachenu, kulimukone kuikola zende kaufela.
Goeie nuus, Imba het nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinternuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak.
Arikana 36 Namibian dollars kakweli. Kapa kami kwaye kutesfa fasi yetatama, 5% machipisa hamungo tisari kwerize talu, 10% machipisa hamungo tisari kwerize sirela, 25% machipisa hamungo tisari kwerize lishumiteri. Muketeri kwerizo muvata, kulimukone kukala kuikola zendezeo imba imiswalezi fama chipisa. Imba, toku vukandiri fasi kaufela. Muipe kwa lisevelezo imba kachenu kulimukone kuikola zende kaufela.
The next day I kind of thought, like, this is time to do it, and I left with just the clothes on my back.
How did it feel to be out of the house, and how did it feel to be away from her free?
At first it felt really weird. Because, I mean, after the police came round and I told them, they were shocked. And the police had said to me, the amount that it had accelerated, that it was one of the worst cases of control and coercive behaviour that they'd seen. Mainly because of how quickly things accelerated. I mean, we were only in a relationship for 8 months. And, you know, between the period of November to...
And this is what we are talking about, right? When the relationship is just moving too fast. It's moving too fast. It's out of control. And you think that, yeah, but when you're ready, you're ready. When you meet the one, you meet the one. No, sis. No, Buddha. It's not meeting the one we're already what. No. When something is too fast, it's too fast. You guys can't just meet yesterday and then you guys are moving in together, making such drastic life decisions, right? It's too fast and there's something wrong. Identify to save your life.
March or end of February, beginning of March time, you know, the amount of abuse that had happened during that time, they'd never seen anything like it.
What happened in terms of the police action?
So it took a while to kind of get the charge placed. And this is the thing, you know, is... Because your brain is conditioned for that person. So after I'd made the report, so I contacted her and said, look, you know, we don't need to do this to each other. You know, just give me my belongings back. Like, just get some help and we'll just go our separate ways and we'll just leave it as that. And then she got me arrested for harassment. So then I was arrested, placed on bail. So we were both placed on bail against each other, which is during that time when I started having really negative thoughts and I became suicidal. I'd tried to walk out into traffic quite a few times and, tried to do things with a knife and stuff in the kitchen. I tried to cut myself and things like that. When luckily I'd gone back with my parents and they'd stopped me at the time. And then they said, look, you know, and I recognized at that point that I needed help. And then I went through therapy. So I went through psychotherapy, which took a long time. It took probably at least a year. Like, these things don't solve overnight, you know. I knew it was going to be a long road.
The importance of therapy, the importance of therapy, the importance of therapy. Guys, talk to someone. How?
But I knew I needed to seek that help, you know, to get myself back on track again. I went through the therapy, and then they, as I was doing that, then they decided to place the charge on her and drop the charge against me. I had to write numerous statements during that time. It was kind of reliving it all the time. It was kind of going through reliving all the evidence, everything, you know. And I mean, luckily I had all the overwhelming evidence on, you know, through the text messages, emails, everything, the phone calls, the pictures that I managed to take of the cuts, the bruises.
And what was the conviction that she was given after the court trial?
So she was given a, so she pleaded guilty, 3 days into the trial, and she was given a 2-year suspended sentence with, a mandated 35-day rehabilitation order by the judge and a 5-year restraining order against me and my parents.
And how did you feel about that conviction?
At the time, I felt frustrated about it, because I felt, you know, if this was a male, then would it have been the same outcome?
Why have you decided to share your story and speak out about your experience?
I think just because there is a stigmatism out there in society still, you know, that, you know, this can and does happen to men. And that if it can reach wider and can help somebody, you know, well, both male and female, recognize the signs and symptoms of domestic abuse and control and coercive behavior to try and get out of a bad situation, you know, try and reach out for help, then this is worthwhile doing it, you know. My life is back on track again, so it shows you, I think, that you can come out of this, you know, a better person. I'm at the stage now where I'm starting to date again, and I am hopeful for the future.
He looked young. He did look young, but it was after the marriage that I knew that.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Yo. The world is such a wild place, and the world is such a yo. It is intense to know what people are going through out there in the world. And if you can relate to any of our storytellings and our conversations that we are listening to tonight, right? Please, 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 please don't hesitate to look for assistance. Assistance is always there. Assistance is always there because how? So, ladies and gentlemen, the next conversation that we are going to be having, or the next conversation that we're going to be listening to, is what happens when your mom is a religious nut. And I'm saying this with my chest pushed outside, because many don't believe that it's possible, because you guys are in the church most. She's a good person. She's a Christian. She's a good person. She's so nice. She's nice because she believes in Jesus. But what happens when your faith starts to, it starts to hinder other people's human rights, eh? When you are telling me, you are a dirty demon. You are a demon. You are a demon. That is verbal abuse, you people, guys. That is verbal abuse. When you are forcing me, you must wash your hair and you must cut your hair, and then you are beating the devil out of me. That is physical abuse, guys. Guys, 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 guys. I think that, we are living in situations that we have normalized simply because, I mean, it's my mom. She would never. You guys always assume that parents and people, it's my lover. He loves me. It's my mom. She loves me. It's my dad. He loves me. You guys always assume that people are bound by the laws of nature to love you, to appreciate you, to not treat you badly, to not abuse you. But they actually are. And in many cases, you won't be able to identify these things because you are busy gaslighting yourself into believing that, no, it's not like that, matriarch. My mom would never do that. My mom loves me. My mom is a saint. My mom goes to church every Sunday, bruh. Just because she goes to church doesn't mean that she is actually doing the correct things. There's a scene in Four Colored Girls, right? Where this woman worships Elohim, and when you get into the house, you must be drenched with what, and then it's candles burning the whole time, and it's incense, and it's what, and you are a dirty somebody demon. And the mother was basically going crazy. The mother had a mental underlying mental condition, right? And everybody just, she was not talking to people because people are demons, and she's not answering people because people are demons. And it was an underlined mental health condition, and nobody saw it because she was hiding behind being an extreme Illinoisist, or I don't know what they call them, but she was an extreme Christian, so to say, right? And I think that when we look at certain people that are in certain groups of religions or groups or cults of churches and so forth, right? We should be able to identify when something is pure madness. Your mother is not normal for taking the title deed of the house to the pastor so that the pastor can have it. No, there's something wrong. There's something wrong. She's either being gaslit, manipulated, or there's something wrong. It is not normal for you to resign from work, withdraw your whole entire pension, and then leave it under a tree. It's not normal. It's not normal behavior. There's something else that is happening that is putting you in such a vulnerable space, right? That you want a way out, and you're willing to sacrifice whatever it is to sacrifice. Like your whole entire pension. You quit your job and then you leave your pension under a tree in a briefcase. And then when you turn around, apparently that's how you paid your what, the demons are going to be gone. And there are ghosts in your house and this what, and this what. It's not normal behavior. It's not normal behavior for you to go and give the car to the church. What are you gonna use, auntie? What about your kids, auntie? What problems are you having inside your life, auntie, that you need to get rid of? What kind of demons are haunting you, sis? And I'm talking about auntie because, the next conversation that we're going to hear is how somebody's mother tried to kill him, literally. And she's a religious woman. She's a whole religious woman. And she tried to kill him, but we are going to listen to how it happened and how his life was. That's why we have to talk about everything. When we're telling stories, we have to talk about things from the beginning. We can't just say, yeah, my mom just started going to church and all of that. No, we have to talk about everything. How did you grow up, sis? How did you grow up in that house? What type of person was your mother? Why did your dad leave? Did your dad not leave because your mother pulled up on him with a machete one day? Did your dad not leave after she stabbed him a couple of times? Did your dad not leave because your mom has been violent? Did your mother ever break your arm? Why are we not talking about that? So that people that can assist our people can assist them properly, knowing that there is a history of violence. There's a history of somewhat assumed to be underlined mental health conditions. We don't tell the truth. Even when the police comes, he was just like that. He just started drinking and then he started acting out. No, you must talk about every single time that this person hears voices. You must talk about every single time that this person is just beating you guys left, right, and center in your houses. You guys are telling people things like, yeah, but we don't talk our things. Everybody has things, but we don't talk our things. You don't talk your things until that person wakes up one day and cuts you guys all into small pieces and feeds you guys to the dogs. Is that what we're expecting? We don't talk about it as a community. We are not even trying to strong arm these people. We just know Omar Sarki is being beaten by the grandson there because the grandson is on crack. We all know this. And as a community, nobody's coming through. Nobody's calling the police. Nobody's protecting Omar Sarki. Nothing is happening until Omar Sarki is killed. until the whole entire household is killed, and now he wants to get confirmed because his grandmother always wanted him to get confirmed. Come on, guys. Hoop man. Me.
Great news. Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
So we're talking about it, ne? We're talking about the zalis that we're all having. Yeah, we're talking about the zalis that we're having, and apparently we believe so much in them and everything that they are doing that is sinister and not normal, we are normalizing because they go to church. We are normalizing bad behavior because people hide under the cloak of religion. We are normalizing violent behavior because people are law enforcement. Now, if you are having your dad that's law enforcement and he's really honestly just abusing you guys in that house, but you say things like, no, but he's a police. How, is the police officer allowed to just be harassing you? Is the lawyer allowed to just be harassing you? Is the doctor allowed to just be harassing you? Why can't we identify? Is it because we're scared? Of course we're scared. But many people don't even know that this is a bad situation. Many people don't even know that this is bad, man. This is bad, and I'm walking away from this. This is bad. This is narcissistic. This is bat crazy. I almost said the S word, but this is bat crazy. Because how? Yeah? Your mother is soaking your head into, every single time you do something wrong, she soaks your head into a bathtub full of water, basically trying to drown you, eh? Taking out the demons outside of you, and you don't think that this is absolutely bad behavior. Of course you wouldn't. But maybe you must ask. Start asking. How's your relationship with your parents? What type of household do you come from? Ask your friends, and then you will realize, ne, that most of the things that go on in your house are not normal. Ask. Or you can even realize that your house is pretty normal compared to the things that they go through. Do you know that there are certain people that have been sexually abused, and in their minds, right, because it started happening when they were so young, in their minds, they think that all daddies do that. They think that all stepfathers do that. They think that all brothers do that. They think that all cousins do that. They think that every single other girl at their school is going through that. Do you know that? Do you know that there are people that have been through traumatizing and horrific things that just because of exposure, just because nobody's talking about it or asking questions, right? They assume it to be normal. So they normalize bad things. And what do you think happens to the child that normalizes something bad? They grow up and think that it's absolutely okay to bust on a woman. It's absolutely okay to beat on a woman. It's absolutely okay to beat on a man. It's absolutely okay to be violent. Why? Because we grew up in violence and it's absolutely normal. Just like you people that are speeding. You guys are speeding and you are with youngins, you are with children in the car, and you think that these children are not going to wake up and grow up and start speeding, and now we have calamities. We have silent pandemics that we don't talk about in this country because we don't understand the root cause. But most of all our troubles come from our childhood. And I'm not talking about your childhood only. I'm talking about the childhood that your parents had that they also imposed onto you, and you are imposing onto your children. And your children are sure as hell going to continue the cycle. And now you're going to have traumatized grandchildren that you love so much, right? And by the time that the grandchildren come, you are going to be old and frail and no longer doing all these things that you did to their parents. You are not going to be in that stage anymore. You're going to be a loving oma, a loving opa. You don't even beat kids and you don't do those things. But do you know who's going to be whooping those children's bum bums? Is your child. Your child is going to be abusive. Your child is going to be a master manipulator. Your child is going to be avoidant. Your child is going to be terrible. You know why? Because you were terrible. And we don't identify it. I'm not saying it's wholly your fault. Like, it's not wholeheartedly your fault. But at some point, right, especially if you've been chilling with the matriarch, at some point, right, we identified every single thing under the sun. We have talked about it. Sexual abuse. We have talked about it. Emotional, financial. We have talked about everything. There has to be something within your spirit that gives you, kucha, this thing that I'm doing right here must be wrong. That's why the matriarch is here. The matriarch is most put on the radio so that she can pull heartstrings. Eventually, you know that there's something that I'm doing that's not right. Hmm? Or are you pretending that you cannot hear me tonight? Are you guys pretending? Are you guys on the other side saying, preach? But you can't say it loud enough. Just the same way as you can't speak up. That's the same way as you can't free yourself. The best freedom you can have is knowledge. The best freedom you can have is wisdom. The best freedom you can have is the knowing. Knowing that this is right and this is wrong. Knowing. Know it. So that even if you can't get out of your situation, raise the next generation to be better. We are already doomed. We are traumatized. We are beat down. We are violated. We are addicts. We are doomed, 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 doomed. If you are changing in this generation and in this pandemic, I applaud you. I'm like, wow. There's another one of my brothers and my sisters changing. That's wonderful. That's amazing. If you are changing after everything that you've been through, after everything that you've seen, after everything that you have been a part of, if you are changing, if you are choosing the better path, if you are choosing to be a wonderful person, I applaud you. I really do. Because we know it's hard. There are days when we wake up and we just want to be the bad guy also. There are days when we wake up and we want to abandon our children. Eh? Just the same way as we were abandoned by those that couldn't see fit to be parents. But we know that that's wrong. And we kind of love the little buggers. So we try. We keep trying and we keep trying and we keep trying. But sometimes we look at the opposite. The one that was the assistant to the copulation of these children, to the manufacturing of these children. Sometimes we look at the other side of it that's living their lives and we say, wow, must be nice to be an occasional parent. If you are changing, if you are choosing to break generational curses, if you are choosing to break generational habits, right? Because your mother is a single mother, your grandmother was a single mother, your great grandmother was a single mother, all your aunts are single mothers, and you are trying to break the chain. You're trying to break the chain and then you are now stuck in a relationship where you're like, till death do us part, baby. It is going to be death do us part if it is not perfect. If it is not perfect, listen, you will still be breaking a generational curse if you choose to walk away from a relationship that no longer serves you. If you choose to walk away from a relationship that is beating you down and making you frail. Your children would rather have an alive father that is healthy than a beat down father that is unhealthy. Your children would rather have two parents that are apart and extremely happy than two parents that are apparently trying to make it work because they are trying to break up generational curses and generational what? The problem is not the marriage. The problem is the person that you pick to be in the marriage with. The problem is the circumstances around the person's change. The problem is the circumstances around your change. The problem is deeper than this thing called relationship, togetherness in it. It's deeper than that. It must be a pattern. It must be a pattern that you must change. Because if you are thinking that the pattern is that all your parents, all your matriarchal cycle, right? All of them that are within your heritage, your whole entire matriarchal cycle is single parents, or single mothers, and you want to break this chain, then the chain is not marriage. Marriage does not break this chain, darling. What needs to happen is you need to look at behavior. You need to look at behavior and you need to look at patterns. You need to look at hereditary patterns. If every single woman in your household is shouting at a man like crazy, like a prison warden, and you are doing exactly the same, so it might not be marriage. It might just be the way you talk to men. It might just be the way you address them. It might be the disrespect in your tone. It might be your demeanor. It might be the hyper-independence that you are facing, sis. It might be. It might be that hyper-independence that you are facing, and now you can't allow a man to be a man within the territory that he set up, because you want to be the man. You want to wear the pants. You also want to go to the gutters and change gutters. You also want to paint the house because you can do this. And you want to be hyper-independent. Can you please get me some bread at the store? No, I'm a little busy right now, but I'll get it after work. Never mind. I'll just do it myself. Why? Because I'm my own man. Ha! The problem is not marriage. The problem is your demeanor and your attitude. The problem is your anger. The problem is you. And it might not fully be you because you carry your ancestors within you. So maybe that's the cycle that you need to break. Maybe the cycle is that all your matriarchal lineage didn't know how to pick good men. And you fell into the cycle, sis. You fell into the cycle and you became another statistic. And now you're holding on to this marriage for dear life. Please don't leave me. Please don't leave me. You are begging and screaming, kicking and screaming. You are begging for a relationship to stay so that you don't embarrass yourself in your village. But in your village, all they want for you is life. Sure, we all have nemesis. We all have somebody that's going to laugh at our demise, of course. But at least the rest of the world is rooting for you. And how important is this person's opinion if this person doesn't feed you? How important is this person's opinion if this person does not contribute to your life in any way? How important is that person's contribution to your life or opinion to your life when they barely made it? To the race that you are running. Nobody has ever made them Nandomashenjo Hasharangi. And you want to compare yourself to that one? You want to show that one that you can maintain a relationship? Bro, that person can't even hold down a simple friendship, and you want to compare yourself to that one, and now you're staying in something that's killing you daily. They're supposed to love me. They're my husbands. They're supposed to love me. They're my wife. They're supposed to love me. They're my parents. But what happens when they don't? What happens when every single thing and every fiber in their being shows you otherwise? What happens then? When do we then realize that this is not working? Do you know how many people are happy after their first divorce and they remarry? Do you know how many people do death do us part? With the second marriage, because the first marriage was just the first pancake. And we are throwing that one out because we all know what happens to the first pancake. It's a trial and error. It's a test run. Those people that get it right the first time, I applaud you. You guys are amazing. You guys are doing the Lord's work out there. You guys were ready for one another. But what happens when you are not ready for one another? And what happens, right? When the woman that birthed you, it's the same person that's trying to kill you. What happens when they believe in something so deep, they take it out of context? What happens when your mother is the only crazy one in the church? What happens when your mother is doing things that's outside the church? What happens when your mother is misinterpreting or misquoting Bible verses for every situation? Every time you eat a slice of bread, do you know that you're not going to heaven? Because he who is holy can fit through the eye of a needle, and that person will still not go to heaven. Did you know that you're a sinner? Did you know that by barely being here, you are a sinner? And that's your mother. But you guys don't talk about your mothers, because apparently your mother is so holy. The minute I start talking about your mother, you want to get uptight and throw hands. You want to throw hands on a Friday on a month end? Bruh, I'ma tear you down with my mouth. You know why? Because sometimes, right? Sometimes we just need to hear the truth. Sometimes we need to reprimand our parents. Sometimes we need to understand that through the trauma that they had faced throughout their lives, we need to understand that they've always been a little nutty. And this nuttiness is officially dangerous. It's called Section 4. For you guys that are out there and you guys are struggling with people that are showing you signs that they're not mentally okay, call the police. Call the police, get them to take them to the hospital and speak the case. Let them be sedated and then you section for them. Section 4 means that you are the only one that is allowed to let them out. You are the only one that can go and sign them out at a psychiatric. And in that, right, they can now go and get the assistance that they need. You guys are so afraid of psychiatric that you guys would rather wake up to a woman that is standing over you with a machete trying to kill you. And you want to deem this normal. You can't see what she's doing. She's standing over your head with a machete. What else could she possibly be doing? Praying? No. She's trying to finish you. But of course, she's your mother. And we love our mothers. I mean, she carried you for 9 months. It was her choice. She carried you for 9 months. She took care of you when no one else would. It was her responsibility. Some people just hold on to you so that they can get child support. Some people hold on to you so that they have something bad to say to the other person. Like, I'm the one with the child and I'm suffering. Sometimes they hold on to you as leverage. If you are out there and you are listening and you are teary-eyed and you are all sad and you're feeling all kinds of depressed about it, well, it's nice to know that I know, right? Isn't it? It's nice to know that I know. The number in studio is 083-288-401. If you have some embarrassing things to say, I'm here. I'm always here. I'm here. I'm here 6 days a week, babe. I'm here 6 days a week. I can listen to your story. I can hear you. I can be there. Because, like I said, there's nothing new under the sun, Chomi. There's nothing that you are facing that somebody else didn't face. Everything. Every single thing that you are facing right now, somebody else faced it. You're not special. Okay? But I love you, though. I love you. I love you. I love you. Yeah, that was a shy caller that's giving missed calls. I can't call you back, okay? Mara, I love you. I love you. I love you. I just tell you these things so that you can wake up. I'm not saying do anything about it. I'm saying, right? Know that this is happening to you. Just know that this is happening to you so that you can get into a grip of reality somewhere, somehow. But if you feel like this is too much, seek professional help.
So there'd be freezing cold water and she would lay us down in the bath. So she would hold you down under the water. And of course you hold a mouthful of air. And she would hold us down to the point where we had to release that air. And you see the bubbles go up. And then you swallow water. And it was only when we got to that point where you're basically drowning, she'd maybe hold us for 10 seconds more and then pull us up. So I was born in the lovely town of Cheltenham. And my parents, they both had substance abuse issues, so my early years weren't the best, but you know, they did try. My earliest memories are in a house with no carpets, looking for food with my sister.
How old are you at this point?
I would have been not much more than 3 years old, just over 3 years old. At this point, my dad was really struggling to take care of us at all, along with his heroin issues. They started looking for private fostering arrangements. And they heard of Eunice Spry. She was kind of like a bit of a hero in the local community and was well regarded. She'd already adopted a child. You know, she was always trying to look out for other children. And I don't know who made contact with who, but she had like a half an hour conversation with my mum. And next thing I know, we are packing our bags and getting into the yellow Volvo and moving to Tewkesbury.
Do you remember much of that experience?
So I've been only coming up for 4 years old, but I can remember everything of that day. We drove through the countryside to Tewkesbury and we arrive at, you know, we'd lived in quite a derelict house before this. So to arrive at this really quite nice big 4-bedroom house, in a quite, not well-to-do, but a quite nice neighborhood. I remember walking through the house. There was a playroom, just filled with toys. There was a garden filled with like, you know, sand pits and water tables and stuff. And it was amazing. I remember her having to pretty much drag me in that first night because I was just playing in the sand pit. And like those first memories were really good for me.
And who else was living in the household?
Yeah, my sister moved in with me. There was a Victoria, or Toria she was called back then, and there was a girl called Charlotte, who was adopted by Eunice. Victoria was also adopted by Eunice. And there were Eunice's real daughter, Judith, who was part-time living in the house, and of course Eunice.
And what was your initial impression of Eunice?
Being a Jehovah's Witness, she was always quite strict. Every Sunday we'd go to church for 2 hours. Thursday evenings there was a church session where we probably an hour in church in the Thursday evening. And then you'd have Bible studies and then you'd also have Bible club. You know, straight away there was, it was quite evident she thought we were sinning all the time. She would be quoting scriptures to try and point out everything we were doing was a sin. So, yeah, it got quite, kind of messed up really quickly.
And what was that, I suppose, turning point in her treatment of you?
We were all called up to Charlotte's bedroom, which was the nicest bedroom in the house. And Eunice had found out some chocolate had gone missing in the house. And she was determined it was one of us three. So myself, Victoria, or Loma. So she asked us to all stand in a semicircle and asked us one at a time, did we take the chocolate? I said no. Loma said no. Victoria said no. And she was right up in our face while asking this. It was weird. I made the mistake of laughing. Because it was a very weird situation. You know, I'd have been 5 years old at this point, 5 or 6. She then walked over to the corner of the room and picked up an old gnarly chair leg. And then she took the stick and smashed it across the tops of our feet. Now, this is probably the first time I've ever felt real pain, like real, real, real pain. And straight away, I collapsed on the floor and my sister did the same. Only Victoria managed to stand up to it, actually, which really picked Eunice off. And the next round, so she did it all once on our feet. The next round was way harder because Victoria had managed to stand up. But yeah, that was the first crossing the line incident. Probably within the course of a month, we went from having very basic Jehovah's Witness style discipline to torture very quickly. And, you know, this torture ranged from being forced to stay up all night, being, you know, not allowed to sleep. She wasn't really starving us so much back then, but very bland food, not being allowed to eat what she was eating or Charlotte was eating. Daily beatings and forcing us to tell on each other. If one of us fell asleep, we would have to wake Eunice up and she would punish us, or we'd keep a tally and she'd punish us the next morning, or walking up and downstairs for hours on end, you know, kind of messed up stuff.
And were you all experiencing these punishments and tortures?
Charlotte was never abused, or not that I know of, but she lived a very luxury life in compared to ours. And my little brother Caleb wasn't abused. Now, Caleb's a weird one because he was had from birth as was Charlotte. Caleb was treated so differently. Like, Caleb was never really allowed to grow up. He had this dream life. He was getting fed. He was getting to play in the sandpit. You know, that was my sandpit. You know, he was doing everything I wanted to while we were working a farm and barely struggling, you know, barely staying alive.
If she was beating you and you would have been sustaining physical injuries, you still going to church? Were you going to school?
We went to school, and Aloma got caught stealing food because she was hungry. So that raised alarm bells. I went to school and Eunice had kicked me downstairs. We were starting, especially when we moved to the farmhouse later on, we were starting to sustain quite nasty injuries. So I had bruises all down the one side of my body. And of course, school picked up on this straight away. That scared Eunice straight away. And we were all pulled out of school within weeks of each other and home educated.
And you mentioned the farmhouse. So at what point did you move there and where was the farm?
So we moved there, I think, around 96. An old guy called John Drake, owned it. And Eunice befriended him. And decided to move us all in so she could take care of him. Eunice had never met this bloke before, but I think she saw gold signs. He was in very bad health, was having to go on oxygen, etc. And he died semi-suspiciously because he'd been in he was in bad health, but he'd somehow turned his oxygen off in the evening, so didn't get oxygen while he was sleeping. And I think everyone around him found that a bit weird, to be honest. Eunice had decided that we should all go visit John's body. So we all paraded around John, who was just led there dead. To be shown that at 6 years old is horrible. Yeah, she liked to see us scared. That was evident. So I think she must have got something out of that, because yeah, why would you parade children around a dead body? It's just weird. Like, she must have got something out of it. It's just weird that his will changed a couple of days before he died and left everything to Charlotte. So suddenly Eunice is in charge of this farmhouse, as she is Charlotte's mum. And all the land and all the money that went with it. It's just a bit weird in my book.
Do you think that Eunice might have?
Oh, I 100% think she did. 100%. And I don't think I'm the only one. Once we'd moved to the farmhouse and John had passed, she basically had an open canvas to abuse us. There was no one around. We didn't have daily visitors. There were houses in the area, but they were far enough not to be an issue. Aloma and Victoria, you know, we had a very weird bond. We genuinely kept each other alive, from nursing each other's injuries to, you know, stealing food to keep each other alive. Yeah, we had a bond that was way more than sibling. Burns were some of the bad things. Eunice had this thing where she'd like to get her hand and quickly touch it on top of like a fire coal-driven oven, and it would have this steel plate on top which would get hot because there's a flame underneath it. And we never knew when it was going to happen, but quite often it would be random. She would just grab your hand and force it down. So one of us would come in with one of these injuries and we would try and wrap it and keep it clean. And some of the worst things, getting hit around the back of the head with an iron bar and blacking out and coming round, you know, minutes later. It was like being at war and trying to keep each other going and, like, you know, doing life-saving care, you know, all while still trying to run a farm and be kids.
I know that she did horrendous things. She, like, fed you washing up liquid and...
The washing up liquid thing was she was cleaning our mouths of lies. It's really hard not to be sick. And then if we were sick, we would have to eat that sick up. So we couldn't be sick. You had to keep it down. But you're gagging continuously. In those early years, we were taking a beating a day, a minimum. But then she almost started to run out of excuses to punish us. So that's when the starving started. We were given very little food. Any food we did eat would either be stolen or would be foraged, basically. There were potato patches on the farm and apple trees and stuff. And we lived off the land for most of those later years. And she very quickly realized we couldn't be surviving on the food she was giving us. So thus started a vicious circle where she'd accuse us of stealing. We were. But and the punishment cycle kept going on. So she would start using bamboo canes on the feet. They really hurt. They really hurt. It's like a cane almost across the feet. We would scream when that happens. So she would shove sticks down our throat. Some of the hardest times were the winters, the early winters, because we weren't allowed to live in the main farmhouse. And it was in a horrific state. There was no electric. There was no heating. There was, it dripped. There were rats in it. But those winters were hard, staying warm, keeping each other alive. I remember one day going into Victoria and her being so cold, I couldn't wake her. And eventually I'm like shaking, Victoria, I wake up. And eventually she woke up and I genuinely thought she was dying. We were so malnourished and so not well. Up in the bathroom within the farmhouse, there was this cast iron roll top bath and, she would fill this with freezing cold water and she would lay us down in the bath. And the first thing that hits you is freezing cold. So you almost fight that straight away. So she would hold you down under the water. And of course you hold a mouthful of air. And she would hold us down to the point where we had to release that air. And you see the bubbles go up, and then you swallow water. And it was only when we got to that point where you're basically drowning, she'd maybe hold us for 10 seconds more and then pull us up. And I often think back and it was only luck that probably meant that one of us didn't die.
Did you experience joy, experience happiness as a kid at all?
As humans, we always somehow manage to find the best scenario. And we lived in this beautiful area that the summers were incredible. You would lie in the fields and there'd be deer running through the grass and you would just sit back and watch them. I would go down and dab on my feet in the river in the morning, at 5 a.m, the sun just rising. And there were some amazing memories. We had this amazing holiday in Florida that came out of nowhere. So we were being heavily abused. This is just after all the starving going on. We were really in a bad state. And then one day Unison announces, we're all going to Florida. And we were all bought clothes, suitcases. We all roll up at the airport. We fly business class to Orlando. We rolled into Florida and she was being loving. We landed at the airport. We drive through Orlando. along, I think it's Highway 41, and there's all these hotels and like theme parks as you go along, and water parks and bungee jumps. And I'm a kid from the country. I've never seen any of this. Like, this was amazing. And we arrive at this villa, and there's a swimming pool and cupboards full of food. And she puts us to bed, gives us a kiss on the cheek. We wake up the next morning. I'm expecting our daily punishment. No, we're given breakfast. We're given actual food. And we go to Disneyland. We go to Cape Canaveral. I swam with dolphins and stingrays. And we had the best holiday in the world. And no abuse.
And when you were in Florida, did you feel like you loved her?
100%. Yeah, 100%. She was my mum. She, you know, she'd give us a cuddle each morning. She was feeding us. She was taking us to these amazing things. I want to think that maybe she was really loving us at the time. But how can you flick a switch that easily? I don't know. I've got my personal thoughts. I think we were sexually abused out of America. That is my thought, because there are evenings I can't remember at all. We were in this nice villa. There'd be lots of visitors, and I can't remember most of that. And it's only as an adult now, when I try and piece together the pieces, I'm like, something wasn't right out there. Also, how do you fly all those kids across the world? You know, she has no job. That's a lot of money. I think there was a reason we were out there, but I don't know. I have no proof of that. That's just my thought.
What happened when you got back?
So again, amazing flight home, and we arrive home and we open the door and there's steam in the house, and turns out someone had left the immersion heater on, just like a big water tank, and it bores water. She flew into an instant rage, and within hours of being home, I'd had my first beating. And emotionally, having had no abuse for, you know, 6-7 weeks, and thinking, actually, we finally made it, you know, we finally became the good children that she always wanted, you know, to suddenly come back to the abuse was very, very hard to deal with. And I remember going to bed that night, questioning everything. So I was living with Eunice's parents at this time. Both were very elderly. So I became their living carer, basically. And it was only 5 minutes walk away from our Tewkesbury house. But in that time, I didn't see Victoria at all. I saw Caleb very briefly. Our lives had kind of separated a bit. But what I didn't realize was going on, that Victoria had been going to church again, and a few of the Jehovah's Witnesses broke rank and decided to ask her about the scars. And we were littered in scars, but she was very pale complexion, so hers were quite obvious. And they broke rank and decided to ask her, and I'd say, you know, you've got to tell us. Now, initially, she stopped. She didn't want to tell them. But eventually, they kept asking. And she broke down and told them our story. And then 2 days later, the police raid happened. 6 a.m. on the dot. I'm on the mattress on the floor. It's only a one-bedroom bungalow. And there's a massive knock on the door. And they're... I'd scurry on out to the door, and I open the door sleepily, and there's a policeman, and he just says, "Your mother has been arrested. You need to come with us." We'd always been told that when Armageddon comes, like the governments and the police will be involved and stuff. So we went into protect mum mode. And I basically gave an amazing story of how amazing our childhood was. And, you know, no, she's never, she smacks us once in a while, but, you know, oh yeah, we have the best food in the world. And for an hour and a half, I just sat there and basically lied to them and said everything was fine. But it didn't feel like I was lying. It felt like I was protecting our family and Jehovah. It just felt right at the time. So the police decided that they'd end the interview there. And I was, what I didn't realize is some phone calls were being made in the background. And they decided to take me to go and see Victoria. Now, I hadn't seen Victoria in over 9 months. And she was in hospital, but she was paralyzed. So I'm expecting to see Victoria in a wheelchair or on her bed, etc. I walk into this hospital room and Victoria gets off the bed and walks to me. At that point, my life changed forever. And it turns out all these years, Eunice had been denying her physical health care in the hope that compensation would be reached. So Victoria wasn't ever allowed to get the care she needed to help her walk. So she looked paralyzed. I steamed out of that room, smashing through corridors. Just, I wanted to get away. I was in full flight mode. That was the start of my new life. That point there, that was the first realization that actually everything had been a lie.
How many years at this point had you been in Eunice's care?
So I was 16 years old when the police raided, and I'd been in Eunice's care for 13 of those years. I was at work when she was found guilty. BBC News flashed up and this lady's been found guilty. I was in the break room and I remember this lady across the way went, thanks. She, you know, she was horrible. She's going to get what she deserves. I remember thinking, one, wanting to defend her for a second and go, Andrew, wait, that's my mum you're talking about. And then actually just sat him back and going, actually, yeah, she was horrible. And I think that was the start of me starting to rebuild and get over Eunice Fry. She got sentenced to 14 years, which at the time was the largest, I think it still is, one of the largest child abuse sentences. The judge said he couldn't give more. So she got sentenced to 14 years. That was reduced to 12 on appeal, and then she served half. So I think it was 7 years in total.
Just sounds so minimal for all that she put you and your siblings through.
It's quite hard on the victims, I think, to try and deal with the fact that their lives have been ruined. You know, the thing is, she got 7 years in total. But for us, it's a much longer sentence to have to deal with the physical side. You know, I live in hospitals trying to fix some of the stuff internally and externally, what's happened. So my sentence keeps going, even though she's now living a wonderful life, fully paid for by my taxes, and gets another shot at life. And actually, we're left to deal with our injuries.
I know that your sister, Victoria, she took her own life.
It took a day for me for it to hit me, and then it hit me hard. And it's been one of the hardest things to get over that I've had to deal with. I've dealt with a lot of trauma and a lot of things in my life, but to try and get over her death, yeah, it's very hard to deal with. Very hard to deal with.
For any victim of abuse, whether it's an abusive relationship, an abusive parent, do you have any advice?
My main advice would always be to talk. The worst thing you can do is try and hide this and hold it inside of you. Any abuse is wrong, It doesn't matter that years have passed, etc. Any abuse is wrong, and you deserve a chance to make that right. You know, there's always that thought that maybe because of my abuse, I'm not worthy to have a child. So that actually put me off having kids for years. I'm very lucky to be a dad. I have an amazing little 2-year-old boy. He's the best thing that's ever happened to me. He's incredible. And how someone can harm a kid. I don't know. He's